So, yeah, thanks everybody for Feast for and Paula and Orlando and Christine Burns and everybody for inviting me out here. I appreciate being able to come down here and talk a little bit about my work. I'll be talking about specifically Mobile Performance Group and the work that I do with them. And I want to get into actually showing you some of the underpinnings, some of the patches that I've built to enable this network connectivity, to be able to network easily multiple computers and be able to share musical information between those computers, okay? So just first a little bit of background. Mobile Performance Group was founded in 2004 by Matt Roberts. Matt Roberts is my colleague on the digital arts faculty. He primarily is a new media artist, does a lot of stuff with GPS technologies and communication technologies and leveraging those in his works. But he had this idea of creating a kind of collective of artists, which we kind of treat our students as artists, that would come together and put together multimedia performances, that is, performances with video and audio. We, obviously, in terms of the performance aspect of it, the laptop is a key technology in order to be able to go and be mobile and perform with. But then we're also leveraging a lot of digital formats, basically. Recording devices have gotten cheaper and faster and larger storage hard drives, basically. Being able to go around and record audio and video, which I'll talk about in a minute in terms of, but using kind of current technologies for that. But then we also wanted to have an emphasis on the non-traditional venues. Performing in concert halls wasn't really what we wanted to focus on. We wanted to get out into public spaces and approach uninitiated audiences, people out in the public, really inspired by people like the Graffiti Research Labs and some of those groups that are doing exciting stuff with new media art out in public spaces. In terms of our recent performances, you can see here, I've got a list up here basically, some things around the state. We started in 2004 and we quickly started getting some national attention and invited to some national festivals around. And we've had generous support from our university in terms of paying for us. It's usually myself, Matt Roberts, and then we each bring two of our advanced students with us. And that sounds like very few, but you got to remember our digital arts program is only about 45 students in total, and that's music, and art, and computer science all together, basically. We're a small university, but 45 students on a campus of about 2,100 is a pretty significant chunk, okay? Going out and exhibiting work, there's not much going on in DeLand. I'm not ashamed of saying that. It's a small town. And so to get out and perform in these different venues with our students and let the students then also see what other artists are doing is a really important key part of our mission, basically, getting our students out into the public and communicating with other artists, presenting their work other places. In terms of our guiding aesthetics, one of the things that really guides what we do with MPG is this idea of psychogeography. The idea that you can explore a place and then incorporate things that have to do with the place into your performance. And so we go around with our digital equipment and we capture images and we capture sound. It's very easy to take a digital camera around and snap pictures of interesting things that you see in a place. And now with recorders, it's very possible to go around and record interesting sounds that you see in a place and then immediately feed that back into the performance. We saw a demonstration of that last night with Daniel recording on stage in the moment and then being able to play that back. That's kind of what our mode is. We're interested in this idea of the place informing the performance, okay? The other guiding aesthetic is mobile presentation, being able to get out and be on the move outside of your typical concert venues. We started out using a lot of stuff with automobiles. That was some of our first performances. You can see some at the top here, these automobiles were actually projecting on the rear windshield. That's something that Matt figured out. If you take your rear windshield and spray it down with, the hairnet, hairspray, right? Okay. Not good for the ozone layer, but anyway. You spray it down with the hairspray and it holds an image very well, especially if it doesn't have, tinting can affect it. So you need something that's untinted glass, spray it down with hairspray. You can then set a projector on the front dash and it projects a nice big image on the rear windshield. And so we'd be driving down the street through downtown Orlando and different venues where we've been invited with our audio performers in the back seat, all plugged into a mixer, jacked into the stereo system using one of those tape adapters, okay? And then the video performer in the front passenger seat performing the live visuals on the back seat. And you can imagine we get some head turning, basically, run running down the street, people seeing that sort of thing. From a musical standpoint, it was kind of unsatisfying because people hear a loud automobile with music blaring out the windows. That's a pretty everyday occurrence, basically, and people are somewhat annoyed by that. But from a visual standpoint, they would turn and look at this annoying car coming down the street with the stereo blaring, and then they'd see the visual image on the rear windshield, and you could imagine you get a lot of attention that way, basically. Matt tells an interesting story. One time he was testing this out before we did a performance one time, and all of a sudden he noticed there was a cop car tailing him, basically, and he was worried that this was somehow illegal and he was going to get pulled over for a ticket. But the cop just kind of tailed him for a little while, was watching the image, and then just pulled off and went in a different direction. So he was more kind of engaged in what's going on here, basically. We then quickly moved into using other mobile technologies like bicycles, and then we've lately been doing a lot of stuff with shopping carts, where we go to a venue and the venue is responsible for providing us with the shopping carts, but we provide all the other auxiliary technology that goes with the shopping carts to actually be mobile, move around through the space with our performance gear, quickly be able to network everything together. We have some other things that allow us to kind of create tabletop surfaces on top of the shopping carts. I'll show you a little bit of some close-ups of that, basically. And also inflatables. You can kind of see this picture down here. Big inflatable kind of translucent materials that you can project on. And they basically create a three-dimensional screen. Cell phone technologies. Again, my collaborator is very interested in cell phone technology. So we've done things where people can text in messages and then they appear on the visuals, those sorts of things. But when putting together one of these performances, there's really three phases. The first phase is going out and collecting, okay? And you can see some of my students here. Jason here on the left-hand side here, he's got a Marantz recorder. These Marantz recorders are great. If you don't have one, the M-Audio has some digital recorders, basically. They record CD-quality audio right onto a flash card, similar to what you'd have in a still camera, basically. And then they have a USB port on the side, so you just connect the USB port to your computer and you dump everything. So all the days of recording with a tape, and then you have to play back the tape into the computer to digitize it or to dump the data, basically, it moves very quickly. Same thing with cameras now. With these flash-based cameras, it's very easy to just connect with the USB port and dump all your video, and it comes out on a QuickTime format, and it's ready to go to use in your Max Patch, basically, after a day of collecting. So what's interesting about this is the students are out kind of in public spaces. They have to interact with people. They have to tell, you know, people confront them, like, what are you doing? Why are you connecting a contact microphone to that wall and banging on it and all those sorts of things? And it helps them to have to engage with an uninitiated public, have to explain what it is they do, have to have a reason and a justification for why they're out there in public. And it's different than engaging with people inside the department. It's different than engaging with people just in a university community. They have to engage with people that have no idea what they're doing and give them a quick synopsis, and it kind of trains them to be able to discuss that with people. The second phase is organization. As you can imagine, you go out collecting for a day, you come back with hours of audio, hours of video, basically. We've gotten pretty good about being selective about what we capture, but you still have to go through. It comes off of the card with these really unhelpful names like MZW000004 and MZW000005, okay? You have to go through and you have to find what the interesting sounds are and edit them in such a way that they're easy to be able to drop into your patch and use as either percussion samples or the basis for synthesis and that sort of thing. So usually after a day of collecting in the city, we spend a day in the hotel room organizing stuff. The great thing about this is my students all know their keystrokes very well. They can get through a bit hours of footage pretty quickly, being able to chop it up, edit it, and be ready to go with samples. And usually by the night of the second day, we're rehearsing and starting to get a sense of what kind of music we can make with these sounds. The third stage is presentation. Loading up the shopping carts with our gear, roaming the city, and finding interesting places to perform. I think probably the most fascinating was when we were in San Jose. Basically, we had a sound permit for all of downtown, which means we could go anywhere we wanted in the downtown area and perform. So we'd just roll up in a parking lot, set up, play, okay, and then break down, go find another parking lot, or there's this abandoned building with an interesting entrance way, so we just set up camp there, basically. San Diego, when we were out there, was a little bit different. We actually performed in front of we were kind of the pre-concert music before the concert inside. And they had a number of dancers from the dance program that were doing a coordinated dance with us. They kind of just developed a sort of like a Merce Cunningham, John Cage thing, where they developed the dance, we developed the music, and we just kind of brought it together and see what came of it. And it was actually quite successful, quite nice. Side note about some of the press in San Diego was interesting because they referred to us as homeless DJs, which I thought was interesting. Because, you know, shopping carts and whatever. You have an interesting conversation. You can see some of the sound system there. It's actually just car stereo parts that you could buy at Pep Boys or whatever that we've kind of pieced together. And everything runs off of marine batteries. These deep cycle marine batteries is what you need in order to be able to, especially for the projectors. The projectors eat juice like nobody's business. The audio we can run for quite a long time, but the projector will burn through a battery easily in about an hour. Having rechargers for the batteries is important as well. So those are the three phases. Obviously, before that, phase zero is designing your instrument, being able to put things together, and that's really where the students have to kind of do a lot of, that's what happens when we go to visit a venue. In the months, weeks preceding that, students have to develop an instrument that fits in this mode of working, this aesthetic, okay? And that's where the MPG care package comes in, this ability to be able to easily network the computers together so that the students can then focus on the timbral aspects of their computer, what it sounds like, how it reacts to the musical data, and the musical data is then taken care of for them on the network through this MPG care package. And that's something that I'm interested in now that we've been using it probably for 5 years now, basically, and it's been slowly developing incrementally. I'm prepared to start putting this up on my website and sharing it with everybody else. That's one of my goals for this academic year is to get it out there in the public and let other laptop ensembles start using this thing. So as I'm describing this to you, maybe you guys, I know you have a fledgling laptop ensemble, maybe you want to take a look at this as an easy way to network things together and make some suggestions as far as things you want to add, want to see added to it and that sort of thing. But it's working with MaxMSP Jitter, which I'm assuming most of you have been exposed to. Yes, we have all music tech people in here, or we have some non-tech people? No. Okay. Yeah, no response. It's a mix. Okay. So MaxMSP is a graphical programming environment where you can easily patch things together. I've got a very simple example of a patch on the left hand side here. On the right hand side is actually a screenshot from my performance patch unlocked, and it's just a little snippet of it, basically, to give you a taste of how complicated things can get. But you have these objects, and you just kind of string them together. So the object that I've created that everything starts with is this music links patch, okay, which has these three sections to it, okay. The first section, the top section, the deep purple section, is where you manage the networking information, okay. You can very easily, once you start up a patch that has this embedded in it, you can type in your name that will register you on the network. It automatically finds your IP address and sends it across the network so that everybody who has their patch already open starts getting these IP addresses consistently. And it's taken some while to get to that stage. In the early stages, we used to have to sit around and call out our IP addresses, like, okay, what's your IP address, Matt? Okay, what's your IP address, Jason? And it was a bummer, basically, because you wire everything up and then you have to stop. And everybody be quiet, because I got to hear everybody's IP address, and everybody has to put it in, and it is a mess. So getting this auto-discovery thing working was quite a time-saver. It doesn't always work perfectly, but it works probably 80, 90% of the time. And when it doesn't work, you just have to reboot your patch, and then it works. Then it also takes care of messaging, one-to-one messaging. There's an inlet where if you precede it with one of the names that's been registered on the network, it will actually send a message directly to that one person. So if we had a situation where we did a performance back in March where we had one of the shopping carts was actually wired up with sensor data so that as people touched it, it then affected the music. We were actually able to set up a laptop with a wireless connection, gathering all the sensor data and then send it directly to another computer that was then rendering it into music, and it was affecting the music that way. So sending one-to-one connections, and you can just send regular messages, hey, let's go to section B now, those sorts of things as well. And then there's these musical parameters, these things that are shared across the network that are kind of a common platform for the improvisation. In that, we have two modes. There's master mode and slave mode. So the master is the one that determines the parameters for the entire network, okay? So we usually try to, usually it's me, but there's no reason that someone else couldn't switch their patch into master mode as well. The patch, There's nothing to prevent you from having multiple masters, but the results are usually a little chaotic, shall we say. But so you want to kind of coordinate that ahead of time between the group. Then, if you go into the second section here, we have the pitch information, okay? That's where you can get into things like tonic, like scale, like chord, okay? These are stored as lists of pitch class sets, okay? And then they're distributed through the network. And that makes it very easy for students to then query. And I'll show you an example of how that's done. I'll elaborate on that in just a minute. But here at the beginning, we've got a drop-down list where it says basis. There's 35 preformed scales from various cultures. And actually, I got it from a David Cope book, Techniques for the Modern Composer, the yellow and blue cover, right? Was it page 14 or so? There's a list of scales. Okay, I programmed those all in. Okay, so right off the bat, you can use one of those. It adds it to the structure menu, but you can then make adjustments. You could add a quarter tone to the fifth, basically. Okay, you can add an eighth tone to the sixth, basically, if you want. Okay, so it doesn't have to be just whole semitones. That's a little bit of a misnomer. Semitones? I shouldn't say whole semitones, because whole tones, semitones, anyway. Then from that, the structure for the chord is determined by which position in the scale you want to highlight. So zero means the first position in the scale, and then the structure. So it, in the end, it sends out these two lists. Here's the scale structure, here's the chord structure. And the students can use some helper applications in order to be able to choose items from either one of these lists. You can even, in most of my patches, I've got a slider, basically, that lets me choose from the scale tones versus the chord tones, basically, and kind of set a ratio between those two. Because you usually want to put a little bit more weight on the chord tones than you do the scale tones, basically, okay? That's the kind of reasoning and the justification for this. So just to kind of back up a little bit and tell you, give you a little bit of how this works, basically, because I'm talking in kind of maybe technical terms, broad terms, lists, sending them out across the network. If we imagine a chromatic scale, yes? Everybody's familiar with this, right? Okay, we don't have any non-musicians here. You imagine a chromatic scale, right? And we can talk about it in terms of which note in the chromatic scale we're talking about, 1 through 12. But in computer speak, it's a lot more helpful if we start counting with 0. And the added advantage of that is if we start counting by 0, we're talking about half steps above the tonic, okay? So zero becomes tonic, and then you have all the half steps incrementally above the tonic, okay? We can then take those 12 integers and define specific scales. So I don't know, did you guys use this in your advanced theory classes, right? The clock face and you're determining pitch class sets, right? Okay, so if I had to circle the diatonic scale on here, what would I do? Zero is tonic. You didn't know there was going to be questions, did you? Zero is tonic, and then what? Two? Four? Right. Okay, so we start to circle them, and all of a sudden we come up with a limited set that's a subset of the chromatic scale. Okay? That, then, is what gets sent out over the network as a list, just a list of numbers. Okay? This is the scale. Use it. Okay? The students can then query which step within the scale they want. So if you want the second scale step, you just say, okay, give me the second scale degree now, okay, and I'm counting from zero because I'm a computer and that's what we do, basically. Computer people, we start counting at zero, okay? So zero, one, two. It's going to pop out the number of half steps you need to be above the tonic in that scale degree, okay? That can then be added to the tonic and produce the proper note to be played. Okay, makes sense? Everybody able to follow that, even the non-technical people? My whiz-bang motion graphics have you interested, okay? Then, okay, so I've got the second scale degree. Now I want the fifth one. So I just simply ask those helper applications, now give me the fifth one. And it will look up in the list how many half steps to be above, add it to the tonic, and spit out the answer. Okay, you can just repeat the process. The nice thing about this is that once you've done this a couple times and the students have built their patches in this way, the patches don't care what the scale is. So now the master can just simply say, okay, we're going to switch to this scale now and propagate it. And the student patches are then, I shouldn't say student patches, because there's some of the faculty use this as well. The slave patches are just asking for, give me the second scale degree, give me the third scale degree, give me the fourth scale degree. Either randomly or linear patterns or other patterns, basically. You can do that. And then what's nice about it is then you can swap out the scale from underneath them, okay? And all of a sudden now we want to be in the harmonic minor. So when you ask for the fourth scale degree, it instead gives you 6 half steps instead of 7, and boom, you got a G instead of a, let's see, yeah, okay. Then, you know, the same thing is true with the tonic. I can change out the tonic, okay, and ask for the second scale degree above the F if we're now in F harmonic minor, okay? So it's very easy for the master to propagate and push this information to your slave patches across the network, okay? So going back to the music, any questions about the pitch? Does that make sense as far as how that works? Okay. And so gathering all that information, taking care of that information, means that the slaves then can focus on building patches that have interesting timbres, that do interesting patterns within the scales, and they don't have to worry about all the theory knowledge is embedded in the patch, basically. We've embedded the musical intelligence into the patch, okay? Then, move on to tempo information. You can kind of move things in terms of the BPM cycle. You can change the BPM. Now, the BPM assumes a rhythmic cycle of 4 bars of 4-4, or 64 steps, and then that produces a phase clock, okay? Any pitch changes are deferred to a change in the rhythmic cycle. So as I'm monkeying around with the tonic and everything like that, and there's also a hold button here, so if I want to be making changes and wait till I've actually got everything right, I can engage the hold and make sure I've got all the options and then disengage, and then the next time the rhythmic cycle happens, it'll pop everything to the network, okay? But getting the tempo to sync between the multiple computers took some technical figuring out, so to speak, okay? If you look at a MIDI clock, which is some of you may be familiar, if you've got drum sequencers and you're patching them together, basically there's this thing called MIDI clock that sends out 960 pulses per quarter note, right, that keeps everything in sync. Over MIDI, this works pretty well because basically it's propagating across the MIDI connection, sending out all these individual points, and then you can reconstruct the phase clock on the other side. The problem is that when you switch to Ethernet, okay, you get a problem, because what happens is packets on an Ethernet connection are not delayed evenly. They get delayed differently. It basically gets the connection there as fast as possible, and sometimes that's longer, sometimes that's shorter, depending on network traffic. Particularly if you're co-opting a Wi-Fi network, a public Wi-Fi spot, and being able to communicate, this patch will do that. How much network traffic greatly affects this, okay? And so your phase clock on the slave side doesn't really match, and you get these kind of skips and sputters and stuff like that, and it's not cool. So our solution was to scrap that model and actually have 2 independent phase clocks, one on the master, one on every slave computer, okay? And that's what the Music Links patch does, and just simply communicate tempo changes, okay? Now, what's the potential problem for that? If I start this patch now and I start this patch 20 seconds later, what's the problem? Yeah, they're out of sync, right? So we just add one more message. Here's beat 0. And every time beat 0 comes around, it's like, here's beat 0. Here's beat 0. Okay, and just kind of continually broadcasting. Every time the rhythmic cycle comes back around, it resets, it resyncs, it synchronizes everything to that phase. Okay, and that worked. It works brilliantly. The nice thing about it as well is that if the master patch crashes, the slaves just keep playing. They just, and the clocks just keep going, and once the master gets back on the network, it'll just say, okay, now here, just resync with me this one time, so you get one skip instead of all these little skips, basically, in your music, okay? This then works with the Rhythm Bank, okay? Which is a pattern sequencer that's available to, oh, the sun's really coming through up there. Oh, it's this holy light here, okay. What this allows you to do, the phase clock that comes out of the Music Link connects to this, and then you can enter rhythmic patterns on this grid, okay? So the little green ticks basically represent my rhythmic patterns. You can use quick mouse clicks. There's also some quick commands I'll get to in a minute. But this then converts the phase into a pulse output. So every time there's a piece of the pattern that's been engaged, it sends out a pulse. Okay, 1 or 0, basically. And this is a CD... CD quality audio, so it's happening 44,100 times per second, 16-bit, we all know that, right? And so it's really well synchronized. This is a lot, for those of you that are Max MSP geeks, this is a lot better than bangs, because bangs get kind of moved around and get screwy sometimes. And Cycling 74 knows that, but If you've ever seen, Eric Lyon has an interesting set of externals as well that deal with this same problem, and he actually comes up with the same solution. Let's use CD quality signals and use a one or zero pattern, basically, to define our rhythmic pattern. That's essentially what this does for you, but depending on what the pattern is, it creates the pattern for you. Then at the top, okay, so you're looking at a field of 64, you know, discrete spots. It's kind of hard to find, okay, where are the quarter notes? Because when I first started developing this patch, I was counting 1, 2, 3, 4, one, two, three, four, okay, that sort of thing. So we added these little ticks at the top that help you find things easily, okay? Right now it's set for 16 and 4, but I can change those. Those are arbitrary. It moves the ticks. So if you want to see the relationship between 5 and 3, it'll show you like that. And so you can get really interesting rhythmic patterns out of that. And let's see. Then we've got the quick commands here, which are individual by row. You've got C for clear, R for randomize, the shift left and shift right operator. So once you've got the pattern in there, you can shift it over a couple spaces or shift it back a couple spaces. The T's work with the ticks at the top. So the capital T automatically fills in every tick that you see at the top. The lowercase t fills in a random subset of the ticks at the top, basically. Okay, so you can define these kind of rhythmic groupings and then fill in and get random variations of it. Okay. Over here, we have a patching matrix, so you can actually take these rows and patch them. There's an outlet that corresponds to every row, but you don't necessarily want to send the same row to the same outlet all the time. Maybe I want to actually combine pattern A and pattern B and send that to outlet 1 so that I get the combination of the two. Maybe I want to turn off pattern 3 and actually not send it to my synthesizer right now. So you can do that all with the patching matrix here. It makes it very easy to switch, stop, and make combinations. I've got a few things over here. I don't have, there's a lot to get into here, but I don't have really much time. I'll just kind of point you to these. There's a destabilization algorithm, which essentially tells each row, hey, drop in a little bit and then drop out for a little bit and then drop in for a little bit and drop out for a little bit. That way you don't get the same rhythmic pattern all the time, looping over and over again. You can change these destabilization parameters. The one on the right is in, the one on the right is out. So you lower these and raise these, and it'll jump in for a few beats, and then it'll jump out for a few beats. Okay. And then the rate parameter actually lets you do things like double time, half time, or any arbitrary time, basically. So if I want to find out what 1.25 the rate time compared with 1.99 of the rate, and I can do that. Okay. Try to make it as flexible as possible. Lastly, but certainly not least, this little L row down here with the yellow buttons. It's a kind of random repatching algorithm. One of the things is that, you know, when you've got an algorithmic composition system, it's hard to keep track of all the parameters, right? Okay, and to be dynamically changing them all sufficiently so that you get interesting music contextually. Okay. What this lets you do is you actually just switch it on and it will repatch that column for you every time the rhythmic cycle comes around. It's actually using Conway's Game of Life algorithm to determine how it repatches. Sometimes it'll kill off all the cells and wipe out that pattern and stop that synthesizer from playing, and then it'll jump back in with a few different things. So you get really interesting combinations that way, and it's nice because then while I'm over here doing something in this other part of my patch, or somebody's come up to me and asked me, hey, what the heck are you guys doing? Which happens a lot when you're out performing on the street, right? I can have my patch making some dynamic changes while I'm away from it. And I'm really kind of in the light. Anyway, so I've shown you all the pieces, basically. What I want to do now is just show you a little bit of a demo of how this works. And I've got this set up on these two machines. So if I, let's see here. I want to tab over to Max. I actually have to drag it over to that screen. Or maybe I'll just do this. Turn on mirroring so you can see this patch. Okay, this is actually my performance patch here. And I've got this set up in master mode. But if I turn this on, and I had this running a little bit as some of you were coming into the room. Okay, so this is actually material. We did a performance at UCF for the CMS Southern Conference back in March. And so the percussion samples are actually sounds that we gathered around UCF. Even the synthesizer, in my patch, what I do, I'm grounded in this, to show you how I'm grounded in this aesthetic of psychogeography. The synthesizers are actually using waveform cycles from things that I've recorded. So I've actually taken the sounds that I've recorded zoomed in on one cycle of the waveform and excised that, so that then that becomes a wavetable. And so I'm like completely justified in the fact that I'm using a synthesized tone because it's a wavetable from something I recorded at the location. Okay, so this is the master patch. If I turn this off now, I'll turn this down. I can turn on the slave patch over here, and it should sync back up pretty quickly here. That's the master patch. That's the slave patch. And you hear how they're sharing information across the network. Everything's copacetic in the same key. But just to kind of prove a point that I'm not, I didn't just set this up and whatever. So if I change, I don't know, to a whole tone scale and maybe change my tonic to G sharp. I'm just making some arbitrary changes here. Might not be the most musical thing, but okay. It just waited for the rhythmic cycle, sent it across the network, and now they're both in the same. Okay. So if I anybody got any requests? Paylog. Okay, nice and low. Maybe I want to get up here a couple octaves. Okay. I can change the. Again, this is this computer controlling that. You're hearing this computer right now. Okay. You have to trust me. Okay. If I increase the BPM here. So I'm at 185 now. If I turn on the other one back up. Okay. So if you want to do something a little more along the, you know, GABA and all those other faster styles of music, right? Okay. I don't know. Any other I mean, I can bring up that computer as well. So this is that. That's that computer right now. So maybe it's a little easier to see up there. Really, I mean, this is the way it works. You can see the two computers on the network here, and you can see progress across the top. There's the red light that's kind of racing across the screen. That's where I am in the rhythmic cycle. And let me actually, I've got my ProfCast up here, so I'm actually recording this for home viewers. Okay, that's what I'm showing on the screen. You see it racing across there. That's where I am in the rhythmic cycle. So to play this a little bit for you, let me play just one level. Maybe make it a little more percussive here. Okay. Maybe I want to drop it back to a reasonable level so you can. Okay, is that better? Okay. So what the destabilization does is, like I said, I turn this down. Now it's dropping in, dropping out. I've got a 2 here. Let me do this. Does it very well. Okay, and this will work with synthesizers as well as sample playback. So I've actually got some sample playbacks here. I've got some samples that I've loaded in.
Okay.
Okay. I can clear the rail. I can hit a random. I like that one, but maybe I want to slide it over a little bit, slide it back. And this all works pretty quickly in real time. I don't know. Did I sufficiently explain everything as far as how this is working? Any questions about the interface up here? Because I know I'm about a half hour now, right? So any questions you guys have for me? I can turn this. It might get a little annoying listening to me say feast over and over again. I'll do that. Okay. Questions? Yeah.
So when you attempted to maybe finish the software and
Yeah, my plan is to throw it up on the web this weekend. So, is that fast enough for you?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I don't have help patches for everything, but I also, like, that's one of the reasons why I was recording this lecture, because this is the first time I've actually sat down and done a lecture for this. So this is now recorded as an enhanced podcast, so you can actually go back through the slides and figure everything out as far as how to put these in your patches. And these are using B patchers, basically, so you're able to pull up the patcher and see the interface built into your patch. We've done up to like 6 or 7. Pretty much everybody in the ensemble has one. And even the visualists will use this because then they can use the rhythmic cycle to paste their images. They can pulse with the rhythms. Yeah, there's a lot you can do. I mean, and it's just data. And unless you think that everybody has to stay in time, this is just a signal going from the music links to the rhythm bank. So there's no reason you can hijack this and make it do something else, right? These pulses coming out, there's no reason you couldn't hijack those and do something else. These MIDI notes coming out, there's no reason you couldn't add 5 half steps to it, so you're always, you know, you're always 5 half steps off, basically. It's all just data, okay? I've explained how to make it work so that everything's coordinated. It's very easy with the Max environment to make everything uncoordinated, okay? Oh, okay. I'll just turn these on. I might have to speed it up because it only runs through the algorithm when it recycles through the... there it is. So it's repatching already. And I don't have rhythm. Yeah, so let me add some rhythms down here. On this, I'll show you. Okay, so if I want to do 5 against 3, I can fill that in as well. It's a good idea to clear the row before you. So. Yeah, I filled that in. I don't know if you can kind of see that. So row 4, I just filled in 5 and 3. So it's every tick that's up there, it's filled in now. Just one click. You see how it's running through, and it's treating it, just kind of get a little technical, it's treating the column as a one-dimensional array, a one-dimensional circular array, and using the Conway algorithm, okay, if there's 3, then kill, if there's 2, then propagate, if there's 1, then it dies of loneliness. And then when everything's killed, once it's killed, those are kind of the rules in broad strokes. And then every so often there's a kind of, I guess, a plague that comes through and wipes everything out, if you want to put it in those terms. And when everything's wiped out, eventually it'll start adding things back in. So you see, like I said, it's repatching those. And you'll notice it extends over to these columns as well. So you can actually use the Conway algorithm random columns, so every so often you want it to randomize columns. Check. So, are there no other questions? I explained it so well that you have no questions. I have a feeling we're going to talk later. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Oh. And if I could just... real quick, if you want more information on Mobile Performance Group, you can go to our website there. My website is just nathanwallach.com. You can go there, and like I said, by the end of this weekend, I want to have those patches up and this podcast up so you can actually download them and review things. So that's it. Thank you. All right.